The Dog Point Podcast. Episode 17. Welcome to episode 17 of the Dog Point Podcast. Today we have with us Jeremy Hagway from Hagway K9 in Canada. And welcome.
Thank you. Good to be back here.
And we have a lot of topics today to talk about. Our starting point today is people overcomplicating dog training.
Definitely.
And the reason why I wanted to put it in there is that the average...
started it.
Yes.
He come out shooting one time.
Yes. Because the average dog owner, when he calls us as trainers, is not interested in study X or study Y or the four quadrants. And they just want their problems fixed.
Correct.
And their dogs trained. And we have to not only train the dogs, but also train the dog owners because they have to practice with their dogs.
Yes.
They have to use that knowledge. And they don't want to have to undergo a semester in psychology to do it. Right? But when you look online for information on dog training, it's a lot of terminology and studies and badly constructed studies and worse constructed studies.
Yeah, I think that's why...
This phantom consensus and all that nonsense that is being talked about.
I think that's why I tend to send some of my clients, again, to your podcast and your videos online, because you tend to approach it from a layman's term where it's easily to understand it, right? And yes, you're correct, because a lot of... Now, we can't fault some dog trainers for that, because just like you have different style of coaches out there, you know, some people, they're very theoretical in their coaching, you know? And for some clients, they might appreciate that. But again, as you said, the general public is just like, literally, when you start with the theology, their brain, you can see their brain leaking through their nose one time. Right? You can see it coming.
It's like, what is he talking about?
Correct. And you can see them just kind of completely zone out. And then to extent as well, you could see it starting to become a little intimidating for them when they start to get too theoretical, you know? So I definitely agree with you on that one.
And it does not do anything for their confidence level when you ask them to practice with their dog or do it in front of you. Because then it's like, oh my God, I don't want to make this mistake. I don't want to make that mistake.
If you approach it from, again, if it's theory, if it's a lot of theory, then it feels very formal, you know? So now I feel as though I'm in high school exams all over again. And it shouldn't. I believe, like, for me, and that's just my opinion in how to train a client with their dog, is make it as simple as possible. And try to always relate to that person. I mean, before I was training dogs, I was training humans for the last 15 years. So I know about human psychology, you know? And again, just as you rightfully said, you need to, the biggest takeaway is that human understanding how to train or relate to their dog, right? If the dog went away and knew everything and the human didn't, you're screwed by next week.
Yeah, because it only takes a few days for it to go sideways. Mm-hmm. Right, and then you have commands and obedience like heel that has so many moving parts. So if I'm trying to explain to a dog owner, okay, so you have to have your hand exactly in this position, present the reward at the exact right spot, and walk at the exact right speed for your dog, and they go crazy.
Yes.
So I take a heel that is a little slobby.
Yes.
And then once they get a hang of it.
Yeah.
I go into more and more detail and tell them. So now you just get more and more stingy as to when you feed your dog.
Right.
So that your dog only gets it when he's in the right position and he's straight.
And
because now they can comprehend what I'm telling them, and they can actually think about the little changes that I'm doing along the way that lead them to the path of doing a proper heel. Mm-hmm. But if I do all of that right from the start, it becomes so overwhelming that they're not going to do it.
And while you're on that topic, before I forget, the thing that irks me a lot, and you guys need to stop doing this shit, when you have people training their dog in a totally different language because it seems cool to them, when something as simple as their come and sit, or even just the dog understanding their name, is off and you train is talking a whole friggin' next language. That one is a big deal to me. Like, they, a lot, like, obviously, a lot of people like to train their dog in German. Sometimes they don't pronounce it right. So then when, you know, like, somebody else in the house was trying to say the same command, is the wrong tone, and might they might pronounce it wrong. Yeah. You know, just stick to the basics first, guys. When you want to start being fancy, once your basics is good, then start being fancy with your commands and that kind of stuff. You know, so I think that's a big one that people need to stop doing. You know, train your dog in the language that you, that everybody in the household understands. And then from there, you know, like, move forward.
Yeah, because I heard German commands, yes, as a German.
Yeah.
I heard them pronounced in so many different ways.
Correct.
Right? There is a reason why a dog goes down fast when you say Platz.
Yeah.
Because it's, the sound is like blah.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. The tone.
Yeah. The dog's like, shit.
Yeah.
Right?
And that German is a very abrupt language. Like,
yeah. But if you don't say it and people say Platz.
That's as good as just.
And the dog is looking up, it's like, what are you talking about?
Not abrupt enough.
Because it does not sound the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right? So unless you have that knowledge about the language, don't
yes,
you know.
Yes. I think that's a big one. Right. I think that's a big one. And before I forgot, I needed to say that. Because I see it all the time. Right? While we're on that as well, teaching your dog paw. Guys, if you're listening out there, yes, please teach your dog to come sit and heel fist, the like real basics, name recognition, stuff like that. Threshold training before you even teach paw, you know, because what people don't realize is you're literally teaching your dog a begging mechanism,
and right? Not only begging, but also demanding.
Yes.
Hey, I want attention.
Yeah.
And there comes the paw on and scratches you on the leg, because now they want to demand attention.
Yes. And not only that, like, sometimes you'll give them a command, especially like a down or a plots or whatever, and because the dog doesn't want to submit, they might hit you the paw. They might be like, you know what, take a paw instead. Take a paw instead. And that might be the first command that most people teach their dog. Now, I think we could blame movies and stuff for that, right? But yeah, that's another one that irks me a lot too.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that it is so prevalent.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's every time I see it and the dog is doing it, I just look at the owner and say, that's the first thing your dog learned. I said, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, I said, well, we're gonna unlearn that really quick.
What about,
because it's just, it leads to so many wrong behaviors.
Correct. So usually when I realize that the dog does know that, I usually say, you know, let's just stop this all together. And when you get your basics right, by all means, because I know at the same time I don't want to be a dick and be like, you know, like, don't have fun with your dog. Be super formal. Everything is about training. I understand that to some people, hey, it's about the relationship. You know, it's at the same time, this dog is not going to fight a war with me. It is a pet. It's a member of the family. So I understand that. But what I'm saying is, let's postpone this until you get everything right first. And then, you know, we could kind of layer that on after.
I try to get people have fun, depending on the type of dog it is.
Yeah.
Have fun playing tug.
Yes.
Have fun playing fetch,
mm-hmm.
because that taught the right way can teach your dog so many things, quote unquote, by accident,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and in play, you know. My big thing is with, especially people with puppies, is I always tell them about the three pillars of dog training,
right? Mm-hmm.
Engagement, trust, and drive.
Right.
Play engagement games.
Mm-hmm.
The dog looks at you, reward your dog. The dog happens to sit, reward your dog.
Yeah.
Don't say anything, just reward.
Yeah. Let them problem solve on their own.
They will want to volunteer those behaviors mm-hmm. a lot more because they pay.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, you put a command to it by putting a word to it, and it gets easy Correct. For the dog to do it.
Correct. As Mark is on that right? topic, guys, I want to, I'm sorry, guys, if I'm speaking as I remember things, right? Because I'm going on the fly here. Might still be a little hungover from yesterday. But I think people don't realize the power of hand feeding, right? Like getting a new dog, just you hand feeding the dog alone. Don't waste all that goodness in a bowl. You just get a new dog, hand feed. You know, pay for, as you said, pay for engagement. The dog comes, pay for that, right? it you'll be surprised how much you waste just giving away, you know, free mm-hmm. food. You know, so that's another tip, guys. Hand feed, especially when you get that dog, it builds the bond between the handler and the dog. Guys who have kids out there, it's a young dog, older dog. If you have kids, supervise your kids while they hand feed the dog. It builds the bond between the dog and the kid. You're teaching the kid how to interact with the dog. It's always a pleasant experience after, right? So there's no cons I could say for hand feeding. No, the dog is not going to only want to eat from your hand. If your dog is not eating from the bowl, it's not hungry enough, right? But yes, I think make sure to take that point away, guys. There's so much good things that could happen from simply hand feeding your dog.
Another peeve that I have is puppy classes done wrong,
mm-hmm.
where it is encouraged in puppy classes for the puppies to play with each other.
Yes, unstructured socialization.
There is nothing that irks me more than that, because it creates the expectation in the dog that it must approach every dog it sees to interact with it.
And in North America, we see that a lot.
That is the number one creator, in my mind,
mm-hmm.
the number one creator of dog reactivity.
Yes, yes.
The frustration of not being able to do that.
Yes, correct. Correct, because the dog starts building that stress, that kind of stuff. And just to lay on what Mark was saying, there's nothing wrong with puppy classes, guys. Notice he said done wrong. So the right way to do that would be do some hand. I'm working with my dog here. Mark is working with his dog there, right? So the dogs are learning how to be around each other, interact pleasantly around them, but not have any interaction. So from this young age, we're teaching you, hey, dogs, not all dogs are, I'm going to get to play with them. A good reference that I tell clients up in North America, I reference back to is, the reason you don't go crazy every time you see a friggin' tree is because you've been desensitized to seeing trees. Now, if you were in prison the whole time and you came outside and you saw a friggin' tree, you'll be like, oh shit, a tree. So that's how dogs see it. Like if I'm always getting, every time I see a dog, it's me getting to play with them. Then every time I see a dog, whether it's aggressive or not, the dog is going to want to play. Versus if you taught the dog from the other side, the dog is just going to be like, oh, it's just another dog.
The way I tell people about socialization is your dog's ability to function in a new environment or in front of other dogs and other people
mm-hmm.
while simultaneously concentrating on the handler.
Wait, that's a mouthful by Mark Boy. That is a friggin' mouthful.
Right? Because that is what socialization is.
Mark, you wrote that down? Or you just, you was in the bathroom one day and he was like, you know what, dog?
No, I repeat that.
Okay.
I repeat that so much, I could never forget it.
I was like, oh shit, this guy, where did he think of that?
Because that's what it is. Group classes, the same thing.
Correct.
You focus on me. There's another dog over there, and there's another dog over there, and they're both with handlers, and they're none of your business.
Correct. Correct. Right? And while we're on that topic as well, a lot of people are going to say, well, sometimes I'll be with my dog, and he doesn't want to take the food, that kind of stuff. A lot of times, we overfeed our dogs. Most people overfeed their dogs. They don't realize it. You overfeed any dog. If that dog doesn't have the drive to want to take the food or the treat that you're presenting to them, other than, I would say, in the situation where it's a high stim and it's like whatever's going on here is so much more, well, you know, intriguing than the food.
You can also get that with anxious dogs.
Correct.
Nervous dogs don't eat.
Yes.
Right?
So
and I keep offering the food because I use it as a gauge
mm-hmm.
to see how much has the dog recovered.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if the dog comes to my class for the first time
mm-hmm.
and doesn't want to eat the food, okay, by the end of the class he will.
Mm-hmm.
Because I will put this dog at ease
mm-hmm.
and get the dog accustomed to seeing the dog, seeing the people and everything. Mm-hmm. And then he starts sniffing on the food.
Yeah.
Not eating it yet.
Yeah.
And then he wants to eat it, but he doesn't trust his source, which is my hand.
Yeah.
So I throw it on the ground in front of his paws. And then he eats it off the ground.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Say, okay, he starts eating.
Mm-hmm.
And then I offer him my hand again. And at some point, he's eating it from the hand, cautiously, stretching every inch. And then, so we build from there.
Yeah.
And then the next time the dog comes to the class, he walks straight up to me and wants to stick his nose in the pouch.
Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes you don't you know? You might have a whole session, and if, depending on how anxious that dog is.
Yeah, it, depending on what degree. I mean, some dogs are afraid of their own shadow. Yeah. They will take a little longer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But they will eventually eat.
Correct. Correct. Right?
So it's not, I wouldn't say it's only overfed dogs that don't eat. It's like very anxious and nervous dogs don't eat either.
All low food drive dogs. You know, like I find poodles in general and doodle mixes to have low food drive. You know, I don't get like a high drive poodle like when
it's
like.
But oftentimes it has to do with who owns those dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes the people that own poodles tend to free feed.
Yes. Correct.
So there's always food in the bowl.
Yeah.
So then pick here and there when they feel like it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not necessarily when you offer it. Mm-hmm. From the time you give them a structured feeding.
Yes.
They tend to take the treats, especially if you skip a meal.
Mm-hmm. I find for me, poodles tend to work a lot more in praise. They tend to work a lot more for that affection versus like that food drive, you know? That's just out of all the data that
I have. By extension, the doodles.
Yes, by extension, the doodles. Although I find the bigger golden doodles to have a lot more food drive than, you know, the smaller ones, you know? Mm-hmm. So I really like that breed, by the way. My wife always gives me flack for it, but I'm a poodle guy. I like poodles. I find them so smart. They're so, so smart. You know, which is weird for somebody.
But they're also
protection.
Very manipulative.
Yes. But because they're smart.
And if you're not aware of it, it can drive you crazy.
Yeah, they take the money out of your pocket.
They sometimes when people say, yeah, my dog is a good dog, and then I say, but and then they come with all the problem behaviors.
Mm-hmm,
and in poodles' cases, it's all manipulated by the dog.
Mm-hmm,
it's all created by the dog manipulating their owners.
Because usually when you get a poodle, they put them on a pedestal one time. They own that house.
Yeah.
They own that house. You know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, to me, it doesn't matter what the breed is. I don't think anybody spoils their dog more than me.
Yeah.
Right? I lie down on the bed and hug up my dog.
Mm-hmm.
But he has to earn it.
Mm-hmm.
He has to do something for it.
Yeah.
He doesn't get it free. And when I say off, he has 5 seconds to get off that bed. After that, it's involuntary. Okay. You know, and he knows that too. So he comes off immediately.
Yeah.
And once you have rules for that, I always tell people there is nothing wrong with dogs on furniture.
Yes.
But there is something fundamentally wrong with dogs that have behavioral problems on furniture.
I agree.
Right? So if the dog doesn't have any behavioral problems and respects you, then there is no issue with the dog.
Correct. So like for instance,
on the couch or on the bed.
Yeah.
But if you have a dog that wants to be dominant with you and has behavioral problems and is resource guarding, he should not be on any furniture.
Correct. So for instance, our protection dog, she sleeps in the bedroom. Yeah. Right? On the floor, she has her own bed. Right? I don't believe in sleeping with a dog though. I don't believe in, well, I should say depending on the temperament of the dog. You know? So as you say, I'm not going to sleep with a dominant dog. You know?
Well, it depends.
I'm not going to sleep with a dominant one. If he is
a fairly dominant dog and he will sneak up on the bed at night.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But if I get up in the middle of the night, go into the washroom and I'll, off. He goes on his pillow. No questions asked.
Mm-hmm.
And then he stays on his pillow for the rest of the night.
Right.
Right? He doesn't give trouble with that.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a time in our life where I corrected him for going after a dog and he bit me and he got 3 more corrections. And since then, we're friends. Because he realized there is somebody that is bigger and more bad than he is. And since we have established that, we're good.
Yeah. I mean, at some point in time I would say in certain breeds, like the Rottweiler is one of them. Right? Actually, since our last conversation, when I was here, I went and got a Rottweiler, right? I got a good one from the Neubrand line, and I got Piccadilly Litter, and I'm enjoying every step of it. Like this guy, and he has everything that I'm looking for, you know? He's on, by 4 months old, this dog is behind me on the range. I'm shooting right in front of him. And this dog is not flinching at all.
Yeah, I saw the videos.
Yeah, in the beginning, he was a little unsure. he came with good news to start. So we just kept, you know, grinding at it.
During COVID, I did the same with Foss.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know if I showed you the video.
No. Yeah,
he's on the range. There's two people shooting AR-15s and he's lying down there chewing on a water bottle like nothing is going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not even flinching with the shots themselves.
Yeah.
There's no reaction.
He's just, zero reaction.
Like people ask me, is this dog deaf?
Yeah.
I said, no, he just doesn't give a shit.
Yeah. That's what you want.
You know, and then I went, and the head was flying around. He's not deaf.
He can hear
just fine.
Yeah. Selective hearing.
You know. But he just doesn't care about those things. He sleeps for fireworks.
Yeah.
You know, he just...
Same with Buju.
He's not concerned about those things. He has very strong nerves.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not easily spooked,
mm-hmm.
which is what I love about him.
Yeah.
So even when in the bite work, when Alan was doing something new with him, his first reaction is to bite.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, ask questions after.
Yes. So I find that really rotty Sunday, yeah. Their first reaction.
And then it's like, what are you doing there?
Yeah.
You know?
I like that. I prefer that. And when fight or flight kicks in, for me...
Especially in a country where you have home invasions, right? So if the door opens and it's not him,
Put a bite face and then we'll talk about it after.
His first reaction is to go for it.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what he's supposed to be doing.
Correct.
So I have no issue with that.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I take him out somewhere, I'm his first advocate.
Mm-hmm.
So if I see a situation arising where somebody could get themselves into trouble with my dog, I will step in front of him and say, hey, stop that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, advocating
because you're not gonna like what he's gonna do.
Correct.
You know, and
I think so. That's very few
people argue when they see him.
Yeah, that's a protocol that we teach our clients as well, because again, a new dog owner might not understand about advocating for your dog, you know, and the same thing that you were doing there in terms of not necessarily only advocating like verbally, but layer into that, I should say, with the verbal, a physical, creating space.
It's a little diagonal step to get in front of him.
Yeah, and framing your dog.
Basically telling him.
Yeah, from just simply body language.
I will deal with that.
Yes. Right? Or it's fine, I have it under control kind of thing. Yeah. So that's a protocol that we definitely always add into one of the first protocols we teach our client. Mainly because in the beginning, you usually, like most people, will be trying to walk your dogs, you know, outside, that kind of stuff.
Mm.
And people will try to just walk up and touch your dogs, you know? They don't know that.
Not mine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not my dogs.
If you were in North America,
not my dog.
Somebody would just literally be like, oh, Rottweiler.
But Ninja, there was, because he was a black German Shepherd, and he was a good looking dog,
right.
And he had his piercing eyes. So people were tempted.
Yeah.
And I just put a you know, those Velcro stickers on his collar.
That F says, off?
No. Uh-huh. I bite.
Yeah.
Nobody had a question.
Yeah.
Nobody wanted to know anything about the breed. Nobody wanted to pet him. It just it just evaporated. All that interest just went away.
Yeah.
Instantly. And I loved it.
Yeah. As you said, put that Velcro on. Another thing that irks me and people need to stop doing that shit is your dog doesn't even have basic obedience and you're putting a service dog sticker or a service dog. And you're actually going into these places. You're making it bad for everybody. You're making it bad for everyone. Stop doing that shit.
Service dog is supposed to have approximately 2,000 contact hours of training.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Most of it is socialization and getting dog accustomed to any number of environments.
Correct.
And situations so that they don't react.
Yeah, don't do that. You know? Don't do that.
With minimal obedience and then, you know, the dog in a restaurant and then...
Yeah, you see people in Costco all the time.
The waitress walks a little funny and all of a sudden the dog shoots out from under the table and wants a nip at
uncles. Yeah, because it makes it bad for the rest of us in the dog community. You know, it really does.
Yeah.
It really does. So, stop doing that shit, guys. That's shit. All right? You're lying. Right? You're lying.
That's why most people who have service dogs got them through charities because they're very expensive to train because of the amount of hours of training that they're supposed to
use. And just simply the temperament.
Like no individual is paying for that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is a very expensive endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
So it is organizations that pay for that and then hand the dogs over to the recipients.
Right.
You know, there's a reason for that.
Okay.
So, which brings us to... our next topic that I want to touch on, And that is the use of tools. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I wanted to get him that.
See, you bring a slip leader. You was planning to throw that slip leader on me or something. Make sure I get up again.
No, I had a.
I'm like, why?
I had a virtual session.
Oh,
earlier,
I was like, Mark, gonna talk about tools.
And I have, you have and a slip leader and shit. Klaus here, my assistant.
Right.
And I demonstrate things on him and where to pull how to correct all those things.
I know what to say. I'm not coming back here.
Klaus is
helping. I'm not coming back here.
Yeah. So the use of tools, and it's a topic that has been talked to death in many podcasts, mm-hmm. and that is not why I wanted it in there.
Right.
I wanted to get a little bit into that. Not every tool is for every dog.
Mm-hmm.
So I have Rottweilers.
Right.
And while the prong collar is a wonderful tool mm-hmm. for a lot of dogs, it depends on what you're trying to fix.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're trying to fix dog reactivity with a Rottweiler and you use a prong, depending on the temperament of the dog.
He's going up that leash for shit show. Yes. He's going, you get 10 friggin' bite.
You just wind him up like a Tonka toy.
Yeah, that's right? Wasting.
And
correct.
For something like this, the e-collar would be a lot more suitable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? Because, especially if a dog is trained on low stim with the e-collar,
mm-hmm.
and he knows how he can turn it off,
right,
then it works even better.
Yeah.
You just have a higher level when it comes to reactivity,
mm-hmm.
and all you have to say is no and press that button. And that dog immediately understands, looking at you makes it go away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed. Agreed. Right. Or for instance, while you're on that topic, like for instance, the Doberman,
mm-hmm.
right? Prong collars are a good tool for the Doberman, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the skin of the Doberman's neck and how soft the skin tends to be, right? The prong collar works well, but then I would rather go to a face saver because Dobermans, their neck tends to bruise very easy. Very the slightest on a pinch.
That's why with a Doberman, I would, if I have to pull too firmly on a prong, mm-hmm. I would switch to an e-collar.
True, but what about the age group?
Because the fur saver will bruise the neck as well.
Agreed.
Right? Because it pinches, the links will pinch depending on what type of fur saver it is. Depending on how fine the mm-hmm. links are, right? So I would more opt, and their trachea is very sensitive because of the long slender
correct,
neck.
Yes.
So I would opt more towards an e-collar.
What age would you start training e-collar?
It depends a bit on the dog.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a fan on putting it on small puppies.
Mm-hmm. I definitely don't use it because they don't understand.
I would say 9 months and above.
Right. So then...
Not before. And
mm-hmm.
and even then, I would use it more as a communication tool than anything else. For example, teaching a recall.
Yes.
I would start teaching the recall on a long line.
Yes. Same.
And teach the dog first on a 6-foot leash.
Mm-hmm.
Come. A little tug. The dog arrives, gets the reward.
Mm-hmm.
And then later with the long line, come. The dog is not reacting. Tug on the long line, the mm-hmm. dog comes.
Yes.
Then put the e-collar on,
mm-hmm.
tug and press button
mm-hmm.
simultaneously. And mm-hmm. as the dog looks at me and heads in my direction, let go of the button.
Just conditioning.
So the dog gets the initiation with the tug on the leash,
mm-hmm.
right? And then as the dog moves towards me, the stimulation goes away. And then we repeat that a few times.
Mm-hmm.
And then come without the tug on the leash, but the leash is on,
mm-hmm.
and just press the button. And so the dog gets transitioned onto reacting to the e-collar, and it's very low stim. It's
Which brand do you like to use?
And the dog will then just learn, I can turn this off by heading towards this guy.
Which brand you like using?
See,
I'm asking these real questions.
Because, okay, I have... There's brands that I have not used.
Right.
So I have no experience with them.
Yeah. We're just talking from what you like using here.
I like to use Dogtra.
Dogtra.
For a simple reason. I have not worked with the Mini Educator.
Yeah.
I have no experience with it. Mm-hmm. I understand it's a good quality product, but I have no experience.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to expand on that one in any other form.
I usually use that Mini Educator.
What I love on the Doctra is their service.
Right.
Every single screw, button, housing, or spare part you can get from them.
Yeah.
Or if you have multiple issues with your system, you pack it in a bag, ship it to them, and they refurbish it and send it back to you. And you pay for whatever parts they use to replace.
Yeah.
Right? And they also offer that for models that they're no longer producing.
Yeah.
So even if you have an older version, you can still get it fixed.
Wow.
And so that to me, and they're around since I'm, you know, a teenager. They had a different name then, but, you know, they're around for decades.
Yeah.
And their service has been like this for that length of time. So to me, it's just a proven brand.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that on the collar, one, they have 127 levels.
Right.
So the step up between levels is fine. So you can really gear it exactly to each dog.
The e-collar technologies is pretty much the same thing, I would say. The same thing.
Yeah, but I'm hearing that they malfunction more often than not.
I've been using them for a good bit. I find they last pretty long in terms of like how the length of time you get out of them.
To me,
your battery only going to last like 2 days.
To me, the cost is somewhat prohibitive though.
But I'm not sure the difference between the Doctra and the e-collar technologies because that's the only one we use. Because by the time we got the second one, you're already inside. By the time you got the fifth one, you're like, it makes more sense to just stick to one brand.
Right.
You know? Right. So yeah.
But I find e-collar technologies is quite expensive.
It could be a little price. How much for a Doctra? Like your lowest level, like entry level Doctra.
Well, the one that I like to use is the 1900, and it now comes with the hands-free.
Yeah. The e-collar technology has the clicker and the
I think that is somewhere around 250 US.
So it's same price.
Yeah,
same price. Same price, you'd get, you're getting a lanyard, all that shit, all that. You know, so I would say they kind of hand in hand, you know?
Yeah, so I'm a Doctra person.
Okay.
Simply because I like the fact that you can get parts. Because there are dogs that shoot off the antenna or something.
Yeah.
And if you have a different brand, can I get the antenna? No, you can get a whole remote or you can have to buy over the whole system.
Yeah, I just recalled, as Mark was talking about playing tug with your dog, I think the other thing, guys, is make sure to get a toy or a tug that is suitable for the dog that you have. You know, like, so you're not going to get a big ass jute for a poodle, right?
Or a hard red line tug
for a dog
that is now learning to play tug.
Yes, like an 8 week old dog. Right.
That is more for a dog that has been playing tug for 2 years and has done bite development.
Correct.
You can use the red line tug
because
they tend to be very hard.
Yes, and while we're on that, guys, I would also say be careful playing tug too early. There's a way to play tug. I'm sure Mark will do a video on that. Check out his Instagram. I'm sure he'll do a video on that. The way to play, how to play. But I think before your dog changes teeth, you have to be very careful in how you're playing that tug because you could literally just friggin' only a Malinois you could really, and a pit bull at that age, you could really kind of pick up the dog like that, you know? But you have to be real careful if the dog is still teething to be friggin' because some people don't know, right?
Especially while they're teething.
Yeah.
Because if a tooth comes out prematurely and it hurts, when they're finished teething and you want them to bite anything, they will hesitate to bite.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
They will not want to clamp down on anything hard.
Correct.
And so, I actually, I teach them the tug of war up to 4 months.
Right.
And I start with microfiber towels and move on to puppy tugs.
Mm-hmm.
And then I suspend it for 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
Where if I'm playing at all, it's either with a leather rug, and I let the dog do the pulling.
Yes.
I just provide the resistance.
Yeah, just you're basically just a
post. So the dog decides how far they can go.
Yeah.
right, in terms of their pain level when they're teething.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they're finished teething at 6 months, six and a half, we then go back into me pulling.
Mm-hmm.
And when they're 8 months, then we can pull fully.
Mm-hmm.
Because the teeth need to anchor as well. It's not just changing the teeth, but the teeth have to be anchored properly as well.
Correct.
So you don't go, okay, 6 months, dog has changed all the teeth, we go full force ahead. No.
Correct. Yeah.
Right? I ease them into that.
Yeah. I think another one is the level of exercise that some people might give a pup, right?
Yeah, I always caution people.
Yes, because
the joints are not formed.
Yes,
yet.
Like it's not even set. Mm-hmm. It's literally just floating there.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people let their dog play, like let them just do their own thing, not like forgetting that, hey, this is a baby and he or she doesn't know any better. So you have to kind of be the one. A lot of people think, oh, it's a dog. Like Vince has had a client come and she had the dog there. In the yard, and the dog just, not in the yard, outside, I was doing eval, and just started drinking from a friggin' puddle, right? Just drinking from dirty water on the ground. I'm like, hey, why don't let your dog do that? They're like, why? It's a dog. I said, but your dog could get a lot of diseases that way, right? So if it was an outside street dog, well, then the street dog one would know which puddle to drink from.
But sometimes, especially in adult dogs, we're not talking puppies, right? Mm-hmm. But in a fully grown dog, sometimes they have a bucket with perfectly clean water,
mm-hmm.
but they will go to the puddle to drink. And when they do that, I let them, because sometimes they know that they need to introduce some bacteria into their biome. And that's why they do it.
So maybe an adult dog, you'll get away with that?
But I wouldn't let a puppy do it. I wouldn't let a puppy do it.
That's shittens.
And if the puddle is in my yard,
then you know,
I know what happens.
You're not safe, yeah.
Right? I don't use chemicals on my lawn or anything like that. Then, okay. But outside, no. If my dog wants it, no. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? And now they have this fancy healing stick that I see popping up all over the place that people use.
The one they're using, like how they use on those pigs, right? Where they kind of tap, tap, tap. Yeah, that's how they kind of use when they're showing pigs and stuff too.
Yeah.
Right? For auction.
No, but they have that now similar to the e-collar.
Oh, really?
Where it's a stim to it.
Really?
Shit,
I didn't even know about that one.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm not going to bash it until I see the science and until I see it for myself. I'm not going to say anything.
But to me, it's okay. If you competing at a high level in IGP.
Yeah.
And your dog has to put on a performance.
Right.
And the dog has to be in the perfect position all the time. I can see it being used there.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, but you know how it goes. Something new comes out and everybody wants to use it for everything.
Yes. Yeah.
And that I have a problem with.
Yeah.
Right? The average pooch does not need it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's people that, because they see it on YouTube, so they go and buy it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like,
another problem with too much information.
You know? So every tool is there for a purpose and can do wonderful things for you and your dog. But not every tool is for every dog.
Mm-hmm.
And not every tool is for every situation.
And not every tool is for the right stage of the dog too. Correct.
Tool.
Yes. And I think that's the value in getting a dog trainer and getting having your dog evaluated. So the trainer could help you understand. Pardon?
By a knowledgeable trainer.
Yes. By a knowledgeable trainer. Yeah, correct.
After intervene there because.
Correct. Yeah, because if you go to a quack.
I look at a lot of videos. Right? On what's out there. And oftentimes I'm appalled and shocked as to what people actually recommend out there.
Yeah. I've seen some crazy shit to myself.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I've seen some friggin'
crazy.
Did I tell you guys about the dog psychologist? And like where they you leave your dog and they walk in the back of your dog and they have a conversation. Yeah, and people paying money for this. You know? So who's me right now? right? Who's VFU group people going in the back with their dog and being psychologists?
And then we have another topic on the list, early spaying and neutering.
Mm-hmm.
The early Pandora's spaying. Box itself.
I know, right?
Right?
So I understand that not, especially when it comes to female dogs, not everybody is going to be willing to deal with, you know, the mess of the dog going in heat, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Even though now, with everything that's available, it's very easy for you to manage it still, right? If you're living in an apartment, there's like reusable doggy pampers or disposable doggy pampers, right? The reusable ones even has a place for the hole, for the dog's tail to pass. Mm-hmm. You could wash it, it's washable, all that stuff.
I have a client with a Frenchie that has about 7 of them.
Yeah. The only problem with the French Bulldogs, I would say, and the reusable ones, is usually the tail is kind of what holds it in place. And because the French Bulldog doesn't have a tail, it kind of, the pampers thing kind of slips down. And
well, hers was sitting quite well.
Oh, really?
But the difference is, this is a female Frenchie that loves tug of war.
Okay, so she's loves, tearing that
loves,
shit up.
Loves, loves. I put out a video with her.
Yeah.
Right? Where you play 20 minutes of tug of war and she can barely breathe, but she wants to go again.
Yeah.
And while she was in heat and she was wearing this thing, she was not interested in any kind of game of tug because she was just not comfortable enough to do it.
Yeah. I have a video on my Instagram of one of our American Bulldogs doing full on bite wake, right? It was a civil agitation with her underwear thing on. Full on bite wig, and she wearing this bright pink panty in the road. Right? But back to what we were saying. I understand that some people they're not into the whole mess thing, you know. And you do own a female dog, right? But I will say let's look at the biological problems that could arise out of this whole thing. And it does not, it always outweighs the good, right? And the good meaning, it's just a little more to clean up.
Yeah, but it doesn't help that you want to prevent pyometra, but you're raising the cancer risk threefold with other cancers.
Correct.
You know, and increase the likelihood that the dog will get it.
No, I am not against spaying and neutering at a later time. When the dog is fully developed.
Neither am I.
Right? So 7 years, right? I would say at 7 years old, 6 years old, the dog is fully grown. You want to prevent cancer later on. You can neuter the dog, that kind of stuff.
What I'm against is the across the board, let's spay and neuter everything that walks through the door.
Correct.
In the vet clinic.
Well, it is a money grabber. It is a money grabber.
Right? That I have a problem with.
Yes.
And then the counter argument that is always being brought is the overpopulation of dogs.
Yes, but,
right?
But dog trainer can see
my
what that.
My argument to that is, okay, so we've been spaying and neutering everything that walks through the door for 50 years. Has it made any difference?
Mm-hmm.
These shelters are still full.
Yeah, correct.
Because we're not attacking the root cause of
which
this.
Which is ownership.
Which is responsible dog ownership and backyard breeding.
Right.
Right?
Right.
A dog from Oliver Neubrand is not going to end up in the shelter.
No.
A dog from Aaron Thomas, one had Vanguard Rottweilers, is not going to end up in the shelter.
Yeah.
But a dog that is promised to be of guard dog quality, that is afraid of its own shadow, will eventually end up in the shelter.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's poorly bred.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That dog will end up in the shelter because it is not standing up to what it's supposed to be, according to the breed standard.
Yeah.
Therein lies the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Shitty breeding,
yeah,
which is breeding just for money and no concern of about quality.
Which kind of leads us to the next topic, which was paper and non-paper dogs, right? But let's go back. Let's stay on the spade first, and then we go into the next topic, right? Now, when it comes to to fixing a male, I definitely don't see the sense in it, right? Until later on, because you don't have anything to clean up. Right? But most vets will push and they'll rail fear among you. I've seen it with my clients too. They're like, listen, if you don't neuter this dog, at 6 months old, it'll die.
It's going to pee everywhere, yeah, and it's going to, yeah, be aggressive.
And it's just going to die.
Be dog aggressive. Yeah. I've seen it'll more
have
neutered,
tomorrow.
I have seen more neutered dog aggressive dogs than in tuck.
So I think that's another thing that they push is, listen, if you neuter this dog, it won't be aggressive. It won't be as aggressive anymore.
And it wouldn't be as reactive, right, to other dogs.
Yes. And it will behave. Once you clip this dog, it'll just wake up tomorrow and everything will be okay.
And what they're not telling you is that the dog is feeling insecure.
Correct.
As a result of the absence of the testosterone.
And
an insecure dog is a more defensive dog.
And defensive dog bites your face.
Yes. Than an intact dog.
Yep. A defensive dog will bite your face before an aggressive dog.
And I know some veterinarians that when I said, okay, you deal with the medical side, I deal with the behavioral side, and I have news for you. A lot of times dogs that get neutered behave worse after. And that is not a guess. That is a fact. And they were surprised by that. Surprised because it's not what they have been taught. And then we have to kind of bring the knowledge of that to the source.
Yeah.
To the universities, to the vet schools. Because the vets are only saying those things because that's what they've been taught. So I don't always fault the veterinarians.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some, that just hopeless.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of good vets out there that are willing to learn something.
Do the vets in Trinidad, because I'm not as familiar, right? But are the vets in Trinidad pushing spay and neutering as much as they do in North America? Is nearly as normal as getting your vaccinations. At 4 months, you get a vaccine. 6 months, again, clip.
It's pushed a lot because of the stray dog population.
Right.
I understand in a shelter setting that it's done by default.
Correct.
I have no issue with that. They don't have a choice.
Yep.
But generally, somebody brings their precious Frenchie to the vet clinic, you know. They're not necessarily interested in and there's only one dog they have. So they're not really interested in breeding the dog, but they might also not be interested in spaying the dog. And there shouldn't be a reason to.
Yeah.
The dog lives by itself in an apartment.
Right? I mean, thank God in Trinidad, I don't think we have much dog parks at all. We have some, but not as much as...
Not designated dog parks.
Yeah.
I don't think we have any.
Okay.
Thank God for that.
Yeah.
We don't need fight clubs.
You'll definitely see maulings.
We don't need doggy fight clubs here.
You'll definitely see maulings go up. You'll definitely see dog aggression go up.
So what we have a lot is the it's okay, he's friendly people. You know, the little Yorkies on the 20-foot flexi line.
At least
where it's okay for their dog to run up on everybody's dog and you hear the lady, oh, it's okay, he's friendly.
Yeah, we have that, but with
and my
with
reply
dangerous
is
dogs.
Always and he's hungry.
I need to start.
And then they try to. Then they remember where the stopper on the flexi line is and try to reel in their dog. You know, or I tell them, one bite, and it's all over.
Yeah.
And then they look at me very scathingly. But I must admit, it's a probably a character flaw of mine. That is one topic where I get ignorant really fast.
In terms of
and I get very standoffish and downright rude. It's when somebody believes it's okay for their dog to let their dog run up on my dog.
Correct. I definitely think be an asshole when it comes to that.
I have a dog that is a bit of an asshole when it comes to other dogs. And while he might behave himself next to me, if a dog runs up on him, he's going to pick it up and shake it and it's over.
Be responsible.
You know?
Yeah. I guess...
Because I have worked hard.
You can't be blamed for that, though.
Not reacting to other dogs.
Yes.
Right? And it's still a work in progress because he is a dominant dog and he just wants to. Right? And it's not out of fear and it's not out of insecurity.
No, it's confidence.
He just wants to have a... Yeah. And so for somebody to just, you know, volunteer their dog to run up on him and for him to then do what he's not supposed to
if
do.
If we put it in the perspective of... Because I'm sure you say that this all the time to your clients as well. Stop humanizing your dog.
Yeah.
Right? But let's humanize them for a second in this situation. If I had my kid next to me and you had your kid next to you in Gulf City Mall or one of the malls, right? You can't just run up to my kid. Either he doesn't know you like that, right? You can't just run up to my kid and touch them. You can't just run up to, you're not going to just let go your kid and just let your kid run up to my kid. It's not okay for you as a adult or otherwise to just walk up and just touch my kid, right? It's weird. And it's weird for the kid as well.
I drive it home even more directly.
Mm-hmm.
And I ask people, so if I'm walking up to you, nose to nose, right in your face.
Yeah.
And I tell you, hi, you don't know me.
Yeah.
And I was like, hi, I want to meet you.
Yeah.
Would you be happy about that? They say, no. I say, right. So what makes you think that dogs feel different about it?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not even going to the children's part of it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because then I fall in the same trap of humanizing my dog.
Right.
Right? So it's one-on-one. If I'm walking up to you nose to nose because I want to meet you and you don't know me, you've never seen me before, would you be comfortable with that?
Right.
No, you would probably punch me, kick me.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm invading your personal space.
Correct.
You would, in some form or fashion, get defensive.
Correct. And I don't think people understand that.
So what makes you feel that it's okay for your dog to do this to another dog?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that is where people then, okay, nobody ever put it to me like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's where it hits home.
Yeah.
Because they wouldn't want it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of times people don't realize, like, when it comes to the way they raise your dog, it's a lot of common sense.
Yeah, that's what I mean by overcomplicating things. Right?
It's a lot of common sense. Yes. And we tend to make that common sense, that simple common sense thing, as I said, super complicated, where you feel as though you need a degree to understand it.
Yeah, that is by my first topic was overcomplicating things, right? The way I see it, one, common sense. Two, you discourage the behaviors you don't want and you encourage the behaviors that you want.
Mm-hmm.
That's what dog training is.
Mm-hmm.
At what point in that developmental journey of dog training did we go so wrong that we need a degree to explain dog training? Right? My uncle has been training dogs when I was a little boy and hunting dogs. And they were very obedient. I remember his German wired pointer walking around the house with a raw egg in his mouth. And she did not crack it.
Mm-hmm.
And she would walk around with it for 15 minutes until he told her to release it into his hand.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have a degree in anything.
Yeah.
He was a concierge in a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
As his main occupation.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
He had no degree in applied animal behavior.
Yeah. No, yeah, I should have a master's out there for that.
Too. But he could perform miracles with a hunting dog.
Yeah.
He would make that dog do things that you didn't think were possible. Right? That is what always fascinated me. That's how I got into training.
Mm-hmm.
Because I asked him to teach me.
Right.
Right? And today, if you do any search on dog training, everybody wants to use a million scientific jargons and this and that.
Mm-hmm.
It's dog training.
Yeah.
Keep it simple, stupid.
Yeah.
Right? And just train your dog.
Yeah.
You know, let some common sense prevail and just discourage you things that you don't want and encourage you things that you want.
Mm-hmm.
That is what, to me, is dog training.
Yeah.
Always has been. And that is when you see my videos, I always explain it from a layman's point of view.
Right.
So that my customers and my followers can understand what is taking place in this video.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy for them to understand. And a lot of them, I'm more on LinkedIn than any other platform.
Right.
Right? And the people there is like, oh, I never thought of that. Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of what I get to. Like, I really never thought of it like that.
Yeah.
You know?
I never saw it from that perspective.
Now that you said, now I say it.
Now that you explain, you know? Now I can see, it makes sense. Yeah. Now I see where I went wrong with my previous dog, right?
Yeah.
Those are the replies that I'm getting.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that is more rewarding than anything.
Yeah.
Right? If it can make a difference in some people's lives with their dog.
Yeah, when you see, like, yeah, I think that's the biggest thing. I'm working with dogs in
different countries, right?
Mm-hmm.
Canada, US, UK, mm-hmm. Holland. And all countries where you have a million dog trainers.
Mm-hmm.
But they go like, okay, I went for two trainers,
mm-hmm.
right? But my Rottweiler is misbehaving when family comes over, right? Mm-hmm. He's not aggressive about it, but he's climbing all over them. And we're fixing it
mm-hmm.
remotely,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah. Just by injecting some common sense into it.
Mm-hmm.
That was absent in previous training. Now the dog has very good obedience,
yeah,
right? With toy,
mm-hmm.
toy obedience, food obedience, he's good. She sent me some videos, it's really good.
Mm-hmm.
But at home,
yeah,
it was lacking in behavior because he's a strong dog, he's mm-hmm. a male Rottweiler.
I think
he just wants to demand some
attention. I think while you're on that topic as well, another big one is when starting leash training, I always tell clients, start inside the house.
Of course.
Let's start in your most comfortable place and the place where I feel the safest, right? And the way I always reference this is, and for my clients listening to this podcast, you'll remember I said this too. You can't expect your kid to go to the neighbor's house and have good manners if you did not start the manners at home, right?
Absolutely.
So that's why a lot of times when clients are walking their dogs outside, the dog is either freaking out on the leash or just badly behaving on the leash, because when that leash is the cue for when we go outside, I get to be on this leash, blah, blah, blah. Versus if we were doing the work on the leash inside the house, one, there's less stim.
Mm-hmm.
Two, I'm teaching the dog how to be domesticated.
Mm-hmm.
What is the rules of the house, right? So, for instance, I don't remove shoes. I don't change anything in my house.
Correct.
I simply have the dog on the leash, right? Same thing back to the food. We have the dog on the leash. If you go by that, by the food, by the shoes or whatever that I don't want you to go to. If the dog is young, is very young, I just kind of lead them away or I redirect them with food. If they're older, I might give a pop on the leash, mm-hmm. they stop the behavior, I feed, mm-hmm. right? But I think that's another huge tip again, overcomplicating things. When I'm training my dog, it must be outside. And another thing that I always hear from clients is, oh, I don't have the time to train my dog. But you simply existing with your dog in a space is training your dog. Mm-hmm. You just didn't know that.
Yes.
You didn't realize it.
Correct.
Right?
Correct. I told us to our client just today.
So if you incorporate, and that's how you make it sustainable, your training sustainable. Because if you constantly see it as a chore, then it's going to be a chore to do it.
Build it into your everyday life Correct. With your dog.
If you make it convenient, now your lifestyle is training.
Yeah. People ask me, so you have Rottweilers. You don't have all that destruction.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Mm-hmm.
But why is that? It's because you're a trainer. I said, no. Because I have common sense,
mm-hmm.
right? Mm-hmm. If I cannot actively supervise my dog, he's in a crate.
Correct. Correct.
He doesn't get the roam around the house and explore and chew up stuff.
Yeah.
Same in the yard.
Mm-hmm. I think the other thing too.
He's not unsupervised in the yard when he grows up to chew up my gardeners and make eight out of it. Mm-hmm. He doesn't get that opportunity.
And people don't realize how dangerous that is.
Yeah.
Right?
Your dog boredom and unsupervised.
Yeah, like, so for instance, just before we came here, and our dog is under supervision. In a split second, she swallowed something no one saw, and she has a blockage. Only a little while after we realized, and our dog is under supervision.
Mm-hmm.
So if it could happen to me, it could happen. And that's me letting people know, if it could happen to me, it could happen to anybody.
Yeah. And people look at me funny when I tell them, to put a leash on the dog in the house. And like, what? Mm-hmm. It seems to be a foreign concept. And I go a step further. with apartment dogs, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I have to do stuff during the day. Okay, take a belt, put it through the hand loop of your leash, tie it to your waist. You have hands free. You can do whatever you need to mm-hmm. do. And your dog goes wherever you go.
Yeah.
And what if I have to go to the washroom? Then the dog sits next to you and watches
Correct.
You.
Correct. People right? don't realize too, like... But
he's watching you in a sit.
yeah.
Right? He yeah. doesn't get to interfere with the toilet roll.
Correct. I think a lot of people don't realize this as well. The average dog, unless it's like a giant dog, is going to give you at least 8 to 10 years. Right? Mm-hmm. If you spend the first minimum, the first year really putting in some work, you're going to get 9 years of just such a great life.
Yes.
A great, peaceful life with having an asset and not a liability. And just take the time and put it in. And you'll actually enjoy it. Because, you know, like I get this from a lot of clients. They come and they're like, you know, Jeremy, I love my dog so much, right? I would die for my dog, but I hate my dog so much sometimes. And I'm like, listen, it's not your dog's fault. It's your fault, right? Because you wait until it gets this bad, right? If you were putting boundaries, you know, doing this, and they usually admit it, huh? You have to, and I like to get them to admit it, because when you admit it is when you're going to change, you know?
True. Absolutely. Absolutely. If you put in the work early and put your dog on the leash and teach him the do's and don'ts, yep. they pick that up quickly. Just like children, right? A child absorbs knowledge like a sponge mm-hmm. because they're now experiencing the environment. Mm-hmm. The same with a dog. So you have two choices. You can teach your dog right from the start what is a go and what is a no-go. Mm-hmm. Or you can have the no-go become a habit and then spend twice the amount of time trying to fix it and
Correct.
Override it.
Correct. And not only that, you missed out. You could have shaped it exactly the way you wanted it.
Correct.
Now you're just trying your best to fix. Mm-hmm. Right? Because at a certain point, as you would know too, that personality is already set. The most you could do is just fix things and manage.
Yeah. That's why some people in IGP, when they realize they made a mistake with a dog, they sell the dog and start over with a new puppy mm-hmm. because that takes less time.
Yes. Yeah.
I don't necessarily agree with that, but... That is what
I mean. It is what it is. Right? It is what it is. You know, for some people, us like, not is a dog is not a pet for some people, right? Like for instance, like let's just say I was explaining that to somebody just yesterday. Let's just say I had a ranch right now, and my collie that's supposed to be, like, herding the dogs. I mean, herding the cattle, is allergic to maybe like certain types of grass or dust. Right, I could keep it in the house, but at the end of the day, that's a liability to me. If I'm a rancher, I need that dog to work. Yeah. Right, so in that case, that person might get rid of the dog and get another dog, or rehome the dog. Right, more than likely rehome the dog, and there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not gonna judge somebody for that because, hey, that dog has a job.
Right,
that's like if you work in any bank right now and you're just not cutting it, I can't keep you on board. I might have to, you know, fire you, right? Now, if it's a pet, that kind of stuff, you know, it is what it is, you know? Like my last English Bull Terrier, he was allergic to life. He was a bubble boy, right? And he kind of taught me pretty much, and back to what you were talking about, proper breeding, mm-hmm. right? Proper breeding, you know, vetting your breeders, right? Moving on to the next topic, which is paper and paper dogs, right? So you wanna start on that, Mark?
No, you're already on a roll there.
So I mean, well, to be quite honest, I spent a lot of time with unpapered dogs, and then I got into the paper dogs, and I started understanding certain things, like, oh, I guess this is why these guys prefer to have a pedigree, not necessarily for the bragging rights, but so you have a standard, one of not only health, you have a standard with temperament for what you're looking for the job you're looking for,
yes,
that kind of stuff.
Because you can tell by parents and grandparents, they have behaved a certain way.
Correct.
And I'm after exactly like that behavior. That is what I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. So I want a dog from that line.
Right.
right? Because the likelihood that I'm getting what I'm looking for is much higher there.
Yes.
Whereas yes. another, even another paper dog from a different line has shown to behave differently, slightly differently. Mm-hmm. So that's not necessarily what I want. Mm-hmm. But the fact that they're both papered enables you to trace those things.
Correct.
And that is why it's important. It's not because the dog is more expensive because it has papers. Mm-hmm. That's not the issue. The issue is I can trace
the pedigree.
The pedigree and, mm-hmm. and what they have produced and how they have behaved mm-hmm. and what, you know, what sports they were in and what they have done.
Yes.
And where they have done well and where they have done not so well.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if I'm looking for a dog for a purpose, mm-hmm. it is much easier to find the right dog for that purpose.
Yes. But I will say there's constant now, right? Because now you have situations where, okay, we have a good pedigree. We have a good line. But you have breeders not doing their due diligence when it comes to health testing. So
sure.
based on the pedigree, they're saying, you know, I have a good pedigree, right? I've the mother is a good pedigree, father is a good pedigree, right? But no health testing was done. No OHIP, no PanHIP. No ECG in the cases of Dobies, okay. right?
But then it again, it enables you though, because they are then registered breeders because they have papers. Right? Mm-hmm. So if you know, if you do your research and you know, okay, they have good dogs mm-hmm. in terms of their behavior and everything.
Right.
But they run the risk of a lot of vet bills down the road because they don't do any health testing.
Right.
So it enables me now to find another line or another breeder that has the same temperament traits mm-hmm. in one of their lines, yeah. but they do health testing.
Yes.
So I will go there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If it is just a quote-unquote breeder mm-hmm. that does not have pedigrees,
yeah.
I wouldn't know.
Yes. Now, I will say this. There are some breeders out there, and I have met them myself, that do really good work in terms of they don't have paper dogs, mm-hmm. right? But they did do their due diligence. They literally did everything. They'll do hips, elbows. They found a dog that they found that they liked the temperament that they mm-hmm. got. It's not papered, but you know what? Let me do my due diligence when it comes to health. Every health testing I could possibly do. Your MBOC right. and everything else, you know? So...
But then that predicates that at minimum, mm-hmm. all their dogs must be microchipped.
Yes, yes.
Because if they're not, you cannot trust the health test. Mm-hmm.
I think...
You must be able to tie the health test to an individual.
Yeah, I think that's like the general standard now in terms of if a breeder was to go through with the health testing, 9 out of 10 times they would... On vaccinations, they would just microchip one time. It would usually come with microchipping, right? So I just wanted to touch on that as well because, yes, there's a lot of pros when it comes to pedigree, right? But I'm seeing that there is also some validity in terms of the breeders who might not have paperwork but are doing the due diligence when it comes to health testing, you know? So I think that's a good one to touch on because people were asking, you know, what's the difference? You know, again, just as Mark said, I think you should be purpose driven in terms of what you are looking for. I think that's another topic that we wanted to discuss in terms of understanding before you get a dog and Christmas is coming up, guys, and people tend to just buy on a whim because, oh, this dog looks really good.
Yeah.
Right?
It's so cute.
Which is a lot of times, and you hear people say this, I'm sure you hear this story all the time. We went to the breeder and we stood up and this puppy came up to us and he chose me. Mm-hmm. Right? No, that puppy could have been just interested in you.
It could be Quasimodo.
Right? It's like... Make sure that... So I think the other thing is, one, and we spoke about this on the last podcast, do your research as to the, first of all, the breed that you want. Right? Make sure the breed that you're looking for is kind of heading towards the goal of what, like, the purpose that you want it for. As a pet, protection, blah, 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 lap dog, right? Now, from that now, based on what you're looking for, you have to, again, if you're not sure, I'm sure guys like Mark in Trinidad, guys like Mark will offer a service like that. Hey, Mark, I'm not sure which dog I want to choose. I'm not sure which one would be the right one for me. I'm pretty sure Mark is going to say, okay, let's go take a trip and let's sit with the litter and see. And based, he's going to have a conversation with you. And that's, I think that's another big deal. Have a conversation with a knowledgeable dog trainer so that you could sit down on and he understands exactly what you're looking for. So you're not just looking at, which happens a lot too. Oh, you see that one with the long coat? That might be the one. You have no idea of the temperament, right? Or this one, you see those markings? I like that markings. Again, it might be a,
stuff.
Correct. It might be a dominant dog when you're not a, you're a very passive person, right? Or it might be a very lazy dog and you're a very active person.
Yeah.
Right? So I think...
And then you have to test the puppies.
Correct. You have to test the puppies.
Which a lot of people don't do.
No.
Right? Once you have determined, okay, I want this breed.
Right.
And I also want the dog for some protection.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So now you go, you selected a breed that does health testing.
Mm-hmm.
And where most of his dogs in the pedigree have a working title.
Right.
Right? So the likelihood is high that you get the dog that you need.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this litter. You already decided before you went to the breeder that you wanted a male.
Mm-hmm.
So me, I will tell the breeder, I don't want to see any of the females.
Right.
I only want to see...
Because you already know, you already knew right. You wanted a male.
Yeah.
Right.
And then out of the males, okay, this one is the first one to come, but he's somewhat goofy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then the next one is a little reserved and behind there, and he's not really interested in what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the two extremes that, that I don't want.
Yeah.
Right? But there's the one sitting in the middle of the chaos, maintaining eye contact.
Mm-hmm.
So, I might tend to want this dog.
Mm-hmm.
And then I will tell the breeder, okay, remove all the other males.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have a support system.
Correct.
And if I want a dog for protection, it is him and me against whoever.
Mm-hmm.
So, that dog had to be able to be a standalone protection machine.
Mm-hmm.
Good. So now with everybody else gone, he must still display the same qualities.
Mm-hmm.
Because if he doesn't, we're out of here.
Yeah, correct. Or layering on what Mark said too, you might take something like a pot or a basin and just throw it down there. Not like right next to him, but you know, throw it near enough where you want to see, one, if he will show any kind of, you know, nervousness, anxiety. But two, how fast, as Mark rightfully said, the recovery rate.
Yeah.
How fast are you going to recover from that?
If you drop the football, a metal football behind him when he's not looking, and he jumps, that's okay.
Yeah. It's how fast he recover.
But either, what I want to see is either he goes and investigates it, or he looks over his shoulder unbothered and continues doing what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime he skates away and goes somewhere, I'm no longer interested in the litter.
Correct.
Not even in this pub, not the litter.
Because, you know, because nerves somewhere
weak
there.
Weak nerves.
Yeah.
No longer want.
Yeah.
Be out of here.
Yeah.
Right? And this way out of here is what a lot of people are not prepared to do.
No.
Because they come, they
go there with the expectation when that cuteness
that we're going to choose a puppy.
Yeah.
I always tell them, who is the main person for this dog?
Mm-hmm.
It's, let's say the husband. Then I will tell the husband, leave everybody else in the car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Too much chefs in the pot.
Because the family want to choose a puppy based on the cuteness factor.
Yes.
Not on the practical application of this dog.
Mm-hmm.
Because cuteness wears off after 6 months. And then for the next 10 years, you're dealing with the rest of the dog.
Yeah.
So it's better you choose the dog based on the rest of the dog.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. That you have to live with for 10 years.
Correct.
Makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Common sense again. And so that is how I advise people how to go about choosing a dog.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very rare that I agree to choose a puppy for somebody.
Why is that?
Because if the puppy does anything because they didn't do something...
They'll try to, you know,
Yes.
Like yeah, they'll blame me,
right?
Yeah. I think, you know...
What I didn't choose is you being lazy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And not wanting to put any work with the dog. That is why I give them, I narrow it down to a litter or to two puppies at least.
Yeah.
And then they do the final
kind of
choice.
Thing, yeah.
Because they also have to connect with the dog.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not just sterile. I say, okay, this is the dog for you.
Yeah.
They must also feel some level of connection.
Emotional
with the dog.
Connection.
So yeah. I narrow it down to one or two dogs, to two dogs, mm-hmm. so that they still make a choice. Mm-hmm. That's, mm-hmm. To me, that is important for the process.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Right? So he put two dogs in front, but I like this one more because now you can choose on what connects with you.
Yeah.
Whether how the dog is looking, yeah. because we have established behavior-wise and genetically, mm-hmm. they're both in the same category. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So now you choose the dog based on your connection to the dog.
Yeah.
Because to me, that has a higher chance of success with you working with the dog later.
Yeah.
Because you chose it. Mm-hmm. You have that connection. So now you would want to work with the dog.
Yeah.
To me, that is an important aspect of it. You can't sterilize the whole thing.
Yeah.
Because then people are not as invested in you.
Yes. Okay. I think touching on what Mark was saying as well was a lot of times people blame genetics for ownership. Right?
Yeah.
So they'll be like, no, this is a shit breeder. My dog is like this, blah, blah. But when you start having a conversation with them, you're like, you're a shit owner. Like, yeah. you're a shit owner. That's why this dog is acting like this. This dog is perfect.
There's a lot of things you didn't do.
Exactly, right? Yeah. So I think that's another thing. Like, people should stop equating bad behavior to genetics. Now, yes, there's a big component of that.
Yeah, genetics always plays an important role.
Because, that's what the dog is going to usually fall back on. But, I mean, 8 out of 10 is your fault. You know?
Yeah.
It's your fault. So I think, like, because then now you're going to give a... And that's why breeders now, they do so much screening, right? Because when you go to pick up the dog, they want to make sure that, as you rightfully said, this dog is not going to end up in a shelter. Because good breeders, they want their dogs to live in at home forever, right? It's not about just the sale, right? The first way is not walk through the door, right? Because they want to choose somebody who's going to represent their brand well. Mm-hmm. And represent the line of their dog.
That type of breeder is prepared to sit on the entire litter.
Correct.
Until they're 6 months old.
Yes.
If it means that they find the right mm-hmm. persons for the dogs.
Yes. Right. So, yeah.
And about, that is what separates breeders from backyard breeders.
Yes. It's I believe that
idea.
Too. Yeah.
Because the backyard breeders, at 6 weeks, them puppies turn into nuisance.
Yeah, it's a nuisance for them.
Right? And they just want to get the sale and get out. Mm-hmm. Right? And anytime you meet that attitude, you know you're in the wrong place.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. And those are the dogs, again, that end up in the shelter. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. Those are the dogs that will multiply when they're not supposed to.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? Yeah. Agreed.
That is what I'm seeing. Yeah. At least here.
You know? Same thing in North America, I think. Same thing. You know, from the time you see they're willing to sell you that dog, like one time, not have an interview with you, not, you know, like we'll do phone interviews first. So we'll talk to you on FaceTime first. Mm. Then we'll do an in-person. Because I mean, it's like having a grandkid, right? You want to make sure that, you're going to a good home, that they're going to get fed, they're not going to get abused.
If a breeder is not asking me a bunch of questions, I'm not interested in the breeder.
Yeah. Yeah. The breeder's supposed to be asking. That's the other thing.
They're supposed to have a questionnaire for me.
Correct. Correct. Right? Yeah. Correct.
They're supposed to drill me.
Yeah. Yeah. The first thing I'd ask somebody is, have you ever had this breed before? Is this your first dog?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And if so, what kind of dogs you had before? Right? A lot of people say, I had this or that when we were growing up. No, that's your family. That's not your dog.
That's not the same.
That's your family, right? People, you need to understand that, right? Unless that you had a actual proper input in the upbringing of that dog, right?
Did you train that dog?
Yeah.
No.
Right?
My father did.
Did you Did you pick up shit for like at least 3 weeks in a row? If not, I don't know.
Yeah.
Right? So I think a lot of people need to you need to just be realistic and be honest. With your trainer.
Yeah. If you're not prepared to shovel a lot of shit, don't get a mastiff.
Yeah.
Right?
Agreed. Agreed. Because don't got any kind of master breed.
Them loads are different categories. Yes. Right?
Correct. Correct. I throw away maybe like about 60 pounds of shit a week, 70 pounds of shit. The amount of dogs I have there. Yeah.
Yeah.
I might have like on a like a good month, maybe about 30 dogs.
Are you prepared to pick up shit in the rain?
Are you prepared to pick up shit in minus 40? Yeah, it's a responsibility, but it is very rewarding. Like I think once you get into it, it's impossible to go back. You know, now I've seen some people, they gotten so heartbroken after the loss of their first dog, like they were never able to face that again. But most people, once you, it's addiction, it's an addiction.
I can't, when I moved to Trinidad,
mm-hmm.
I arrived in April.
Right.
And my first dog was a rescue Rottweiler.
Right.
A male rescue Rott that I got in October.
Mm-hmm.
See, that time in between was the most miserable of my life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I've had times where I had nothing. We had absolutely nothing
mm-hmm.
while I was in Greece.
Yeah.
Right? No gas for the car, looking for work, walking miles into the village.
Yeah.
Right? Eating dog chow.
Oh, shit.
Right? That bad.
Yeah.
But I had my dog.
Yeah, yeah.
That I know what you happier.
Mean. I know what
that
you mean.
That was happier.
Yeah? Than that.
Being here, having somebody. No dog. And no dog.
Yeah. My English Bull Terrier.
I can't be without a dog.
I remember just making enough money to just mind me on him. Right? And I lost my first English Bull Terrier was a pure white one. Wasn't, again, back then the most you used to know, like the internet didn't have a lot of information, one. So you cannot do any research. The most the most books you could really get that then was maybe some pit bull books.
When I grew up, right, there was no internet.
Yeah, you see?
And the only books that you get on dog training was Conrad Most.
Conrad Most, right? Then. Yeah.
That is all the yank and crank methods training,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
That is all you could get.
Yeah. Yeah, so all my information I got from The Complete Dog Book. I don't know if you remember that book. The Complete Dog Book. It was a hardcover, mm-hmm. red hardcover book. That was like in the late, like early 2000s kind of thing.
I think I have 90s. A German version somewhere.
Yeah. And that was the most you could have gotten, right? So I didn't know about allergies, right? We didn't know about allergies then, like food allergies in a dog, right? So long story short, I had to put down my first English Bull Terrier, the white one that I had. So when I got this one, I said, you know what? I don't care if I have to work to make money just to mind the dog. I'm not going to put the dog down.
Mm.
You know, and I mean, that dog was Bubble Boy, but it taught me so much about the other side of dogs. Dog and medicine, food allergies, right? Breeding, proper breeding, right? Because with proper breeding, you're not going to get that as much, right? You will get some environmental, you know, that's normal, usually in North America. There's two kind of periods out of the year where it kind of gets bad for the dogs. Which is spring, right? And around fall, you kind of get this somewhat gastroenteritis that kind of passes around. Don't ask me why, right? But especially spring when there's a lot of pollen and that big environmental change, you start to see a lot of allergies in these dogs. A lot of allergies. I think that dog kind of taught me a lot of that, right? But yeah, it's a trip. It's a crazy ride, you know? But yeah, I'm obsessed.
Yeah, I can't see myself ever being without a dog. Or retiring for that matter.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't see myself retiring.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's like I just don't see it.
Yeah.
It's like some people, I can't wait to retire. Not really.
No, because you love it.
Not really, yeah.
Yeah. And about 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. My wife was like, another dog or a kid? I was like, another dog. Another dog, right? And then, yeah, we kept getting more dogs. I kept getting the ultimatum and another dog, right? So it's and the cool thing about dogs is there's so much to learn of all the different breeds, And there's so much real life application you could get out of a dog, you know?
Yeah.
Especially in the Caribbean, right? Like, and I think that is something that I'm trying to really push in first Trinidad and Tobago, and then through the Caribbean, is as Caribbean people, we're looking, and I could speak for the Trinis, right? We're looking for something other to do than party, right? We're looking for other things to do. Yeah, right? And it's come from, the party man himself.
I'm not really seeing it.
Right? But you see, people want it. People want something else. Want something else to do, and I really am trying to push that whole this dog community into Trinidad in terms of even something as simple as this. And I think I was discussing this with you as well. How much of an asset a dog could be inside the house versus outside the house?
Oh yeah, I tell my clients that all the time.
Yeah. Right? For instance...
It's easy to deal with a dog in a yard outside.
Correct. Right? Even if you poison-proof a dog, which you could do, right? You could poison-proof a dog where it will not take anything from anybody else.
I have proven everybody wrong in 3 countries that ever claimed that.
Eh? I'll introduce you to a guy.
Because I work with a briefcase and 25 different baits.
Yeah.
They're obviously not laced.
Yeah.
But before the night is out, your dog was eating something.
Yeah. Well, I'll introduce it to a guy who showed me differently. Cliff Roger Richards is his name. And we'll have to discuss that off mm-hmm. air, right? But yeah, even if you got past that, it'd be so simple to just knock your gate. Your dog rush the gate, I fire 2 shots in your dog head, and I jump the gate.
Don't even have to do that.
What else you could do, let me hear.
If a dog stands up at the gate, again, it's not something that I really want to discuss in the mm-hmm, podcast, mm-hmm. but...
Yeah, right?
Right, but, so it's...
So in the case of, having a conversation with somebody from the police service last week, and he was saying a big aspect of robberies is somebody from the inside might have given the mm. burglar's information. If you had a protection dog inside your house, right, the one thing they would have to say is, hey, their firearm is here, their valuables is here, but I cannot tell you where in the house the protection dog or the dog is going to be, right? And by the time you hit the gate, by the time you hit the yard, that dog is already going crazy inside. It'll give you some more time to notify the police.
Especially if you have more than one, right?
Yeah.
It's how badly do you want to get into a house where you hear multiple dogs barking from multiple mm-hmm. areas? You do not know the layout of the house. It's dark.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
And you've already lost
him. What you know, there is multiple units that are willing to chew you up.
Correct. And you lost the element of surprise.
There are softer targets out there.
Yes. Correct.
Right? You move on.
Correct.
You move on. And that is the point, mm-hmm. is to harden the target to the point where it's no longer interesting.
Yeah. Yes. And I think, it's something that is a goal of mine to push. I think we're ripe for it now. You know, I think keep doing what you're doing. I think information is what is going to help us get there. The right information, I should say, is going to help us get to that point. And I think for the most part, building, literally doing the same thing that we're doing right now. Having conversations with other people in the community, building the community. Because I will say, sometimes trainees could fight each other down. A lot of times, mm-hmm. right? But again, in this aspect.
But there also has to be a willingness to learn something.
And yes.
Sometimes that is not the case. I see a lot of places where there's one man in the middle, and there's a circle of dogs
mm-hmm.
that are either tied to something or mm-hmm, mm-hmm. tethered to their handler.
Yeah.
And that is how the dog learns to bite.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right? Everybody bites the man in the middle, and every dog is fired up by the presence and barking of the other dogs, creating the pack mentality.
Yeah.
And when that dog is, then has to perform by itself,
yeah,
in the absence of all of that mm-hmm. noise
yeah.
and adrenaline,
yeah,
they often don't.
Yes, I agree. I mean, to an extent, I think that method of training has its place in a certain progression.
Yeah, if you're, of your bite if you now start bite work,
you're green, you have a green dog,
yeah,
you want to start him up.
Absolutely. But at some point in time, you have to move on from
yes,
that.
You have
and
to,
that is what I'm not seeing.
Correct.
The knowledge to take that further.
Yes.
And prove the dog by itself.
Yes, I think
in different scenarios.
I think that is, proofing
that
is,
part,
yes.
that is the part that I'm not seeing.
Yes, I think definitely the proofing aspect, as you would say, is missing a lot. You have a good build up, but the only way to test your skill is to proof it under pressure.
Yeah.
Right?
And some muzzle work.
Correct. Some like in the end you could hit some muzzle work or when you're doing civil agitation, you want to test the bites, as Roger would say.
Kind of thing.
Correct. You know, but yes, I do agree that each trainer should approach a dog as an individual. Like if I was, for instance, doing a program for you as a personal trainer, mm-hmm. and that program should have progressions, right? What I live my life by progressive overload, and that program should be progressively loading into something else, you know.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, a lot of people might subscribe to the cookie cutter, you know. But again, as you said, that's why a knowledgeable trainer is needed. So you could, let's stop and think about it. Even in the fitness industry, you have the cookie cutter trainers and you have the real ones, right? And I mean, you're always going to have that weird gray area, you know? So the best we could do, Mark, is try our best to continuously give good information, be out there.
Yep.
Because I think the last conversation that we had in April was the guys who are knowledgeable are not take. And I know it is time consuming, but you can't complain about it if you're not doing anything about it. Right? You can't complain about it, you're not seeing a change if you're not trying to, you're not adding to it.
That's why every day we put out content.
Yes. Yeah. I will say that. You guys are very consistent with your content. Right. Very, very consistent, your content and your information, right? And I don't think it falls on deaf ears at all. I think you're seeing the change. I'm pretty sure you might be seeing the change even in your group class, even in the interests, right? And I definitely think now at this point in time in the world, you're having a lot more young professionals opting out to having kids as early. And getting dogs, you know? So I think, yeah, just keep sticking, throwing shit at the wall and something's going to stick there, you know?
Well, we're more targeted than that.
Yeah.
We're a little more targeted than that, right?
But yeah, I mean.
We're hitting projectiles at specific targets on the wall.
Throw smaller pieces of shit on a big wall, right? But yeah, I think, keep doing what you're doing, you know? It's always fun. Always fun being on the podcast.
Thanks.
You know?
And we covered a good bit of stuff too.
Yeah, we actually covered more stuff than we wrote down, I think.
Yep, we did.
You know? So, yeah, always a fun time here with Mark. And we'll try to even not have to wait as long even, like we might be able to do something online as well.
Sure.
And have some discussions and stuff like that. So, Mark, thanks for having me again.
Thanks right? for joining us.
I'm notice, guys, I'm real cutting this guy's podcast. I don't even know if he want to talk about more stuff. Eh? Mark, you had any? I'm seeing Mark Boy and I sleep in front of me. Right? Mark, you had anything else? You didn't have anything else to discuss on the podcast, right?
We covered everything.
Thanks again, Mark, for having me. And it was
always a pleasure having you.
Yes, it's very fun, right? I'm sorry I couldn't take a bite from your dog today. Yes, I was really looking forward to taking a bite from your dog. Right? Because as I said, actually, I got into it. It kind of, working your dogs in April kind of awoken that love for the Rottweiler in me. And I just wanted to go down that deep hole, you know? And
Rotties are fun.
Yeah, they're fun dogs.
Because they're so multifaceted as well.
And like such a big personality.
You see, with Amal, you know exactly what you're getting when you're getting it.
Yes.
A Rottweiler will surprise you.
Yeah.
And that's what I, it's one of the aspects that I love about the Rottweilers.
And, you know, for me, and I'm a pit bull guy. I'm a pit bull guy, right? Actually, I got that Rottweiler to breed with my pit bull. Right?
Not Oliver here.
Yeah, Oliver, sorry. Right? But, like this, I find them to be like a mixture between a German Shepherd, a Doberman, and a pit bull, all wrapped up into this kind of one dog.
Well, I had once a dog named Tiny.
Right.
Tiny was a mix between a Prezer,
right,
a pit bull, mm-hmm, and a Rottweiler.
Wow. Okay.
The father was a Prezer pit mix,
right,
and the mother was a Rottweiler.
Okay.
Tiny was, as you might guess, not so small.
Yeah.
And he was one ignoramus of a dog.
Yeah. As you say that, like, what do you think about the Canicorsos now?
I find Canicorsos are better off on a farm.
Yeah.
Where they belong.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If I had, okay, let me put it to you this way. If I'm living in an urban environment, but I have a love for really big dogs,
mm-hmm,
I would probably opt for the Prezer Canario before the Canicorso.
Mm-hmm. Just because of that defensive aspect or that guardian type aspect?
Because the Prezer, to me, more overlaps into the working dog category,
mm-hmm,
whereas the Canicorso is more genetically hardwired to work autonomously.
Mm-hmm.
The Prezer is more willing to receive instruction,
mm-hmm,
whereas the Canicorso is... It's always a battle of mentally somewhat fighting your instruction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But no, mm-hmm, I want to do it this way.
Yeah.
No, but I want you to do it this way.
Yeah.
But I don't want to.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere in the middle is what you're getting.
Right.
It's always a compromise.
Okay.
Whereas with the Prezer, go this way. Cool.
Yeah.
I'm going this way, but I'm going there with big feet.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. So it's more, that's why even in IGP, you would faster see a Prezer than a Canicorso.
Mm-hmm.
For the same reason.
True.
They're more pliable.
Mm-hmm.
They're more pliable, more biddable than the Canicorso.
Okay. Okay.
Now, you put a Canicorso to live among some cows or among some goats or sheep,
mm-hmm,
in the middle of the herd, and, mm-hmm, and somebody approaches the farm,
mm-hmm,
it's a rude awakening.
Problems, yeah.
That dog will...
Yeah. You know, I have to say, I like
deal with you in a very gentle way
for that.
Right? But they're not so social.
Yes, they're not very social dogs. They're like, I love my family and that's it.
Yeah. If you don't... And again, this is genetically hardwired, right? Where they were used on farms.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't live in this farmhouse or on this farm or in a stable,
mm-hmm,
I need to deal with you.
Yeah.
So when you have a Canicorso in the house, as a puppy, yeah, Uncle Tommy comes over frequently, so the dog is fine with Uncle Tommy.
Mm-hmm.
And then the dog gets 12, 13 months old, and all of a sudden the dog is growling at Uncle Tommy.
Mm-hmm.
And people say, I don't know, he was good with him all the time and, mm-hmm, now he's, mm-hmm, growling at him and he's trying to bite him and he wants to rush him. Yeah, because Uncle Tommy does not live on the premises.
Yeah.
And that is how the dog is wired.
Hard-wired, yeah.
And then at 3 years, it gets worse.
Yeah, because that's when they really mature.
When they get into full maturity, that gets amplified even more so.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why I don't believe that Canicorsos are a suitable dog in urban environments.
Right.
I just don't. Because you're always fighting nature.
Mm-hmm.
You're constantly battling against nature.
Yeah. And right? that's back to choosing the dog and the genetics for the purpose
for your
that you
purpose,
want.
Yeah.
And your living situation.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
And
now, if
situation.
You live in the countryside, right, you have a huge yard that is fenced in,
mm-hmm,
and you love big dogs, by all means.
Mm-hmm.
just when Uncle Tommy comes over, the dog goes in the kennel. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. To keep Uncle Tommy safe.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Right? Okay.
And if you're willing to make that compromise or put him in a room somewhere,
yeah,
okay, fine. But mm-hmm. don't expect the dog
to just like be social
Uncle,
and like,
Uncle yeah. Tommy and yeah. be social when you have a party.
Yeah.
Right? Because you can do this with a shepherd, you can do it with most Rottweilers, but you can't do it with a Carnic Corso. Mm-hmm. Right? And you shouldn't do it with a Carnic Corso because unless, even if you have super training on the dog, there is always the off chance that nature takes over.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then the dog reacts on instinct and does something that you don't want it to do.
Yeah.
Right? There's always that possibility with a Corso.
Okay. Well, guys, I know you want to hear more, but they're telling us to wrap up, right? So we'll have that conversation on a later podcast, right? Thanks again for having me, Mark.
A pleasure shake your hand, having
you. I can't see it, but, right? And thank you guys for having me, and yeah, we'll talk again soon.
Yep. All right.